So I'll be lecturing this first week. My office is 4 to 27. But feel free to ask me questions during the lecture. It's much better that way, I find. And the course essentially is divided into three pieces. So the first piece, I will talk about conformal field theories and the role they play in quantum field theory and more broadly. And then the second week, Gang will tell you about the miracles of two-dimensional conformal field theory. And the third week, I think you'll talk about various non-perturbative effects that quantum field theory can have. So this course is a bit challenging in the sense that it puts together kind of many of the different things that you have seen, like general relativity, quantum field theory, statistical mechanics. So it's challenging in that sense, but it's also satisfying because it puts everything in one package. So it's kind of an example of the unity of physics. It's not like there are many subjects out there. There's one subject, and they're all kind of glued together. So I will try to emphasize in this course the connections and the kind of the concepts more than doing very, very detailed computations that you can do as well as I can do. And I think you're going to get notes with detailed computations or derivations that are, I mean, essentially arithmetic that you can do on your own. But of course, if there is any conceptual or even technical question, you can ask me and then we can discuss it in the lecture. So what am I going to talk about this week? So what I'm going to talk about is the subject called conformal field theory. So we will abbreviate the CFT. And okay, in the first lecture, what I want to do essentially is give you a bird's eye view of why should you care about conformal field theories and what's the role they play in our understanding of quantum field theory and other subjects in physics. So since this is three, it means that at least this word you're familiar with, field theory, you had field theory one and two, so you know what that word means. So one of the things that we will have to explain in detail is what does this word mean, conformal, okay? So if you wish, a conformal field theory is something, it's just a special type of field theory. So a conformal field theory is a quantum field theory with extra space-time symmetries. And the emphasis here, again, is on the word space-time symmetries. So you're familiar in your studies of quantum field theories that quantum field theories can have global symmetries, standard global symmetries, that do not act on space-time, but they act on some internal quantum number of the degrees of freedom that the quantum field theory has. So one example of that would be like a flavor symmetry. So if you study Young Mills with NF quarks, there is a global symmetry that rotates the quark, which is the SUNF global symmetry that rotates the quark. This is to be distinguished from a space-time symmetry, where the symmetry acts on the space-time that you're sitting on. Okay. So this is an extension of the space-time symmetries that you're familiar with, which are of the two types. So if we're in the relativistic world, the usual symmetries that we study when we talk about quantum field theory, but quantum field theory almost by definition is a theory that's invariant under the Poincaré group. Let's call it algebra. So this is relativistic quantum field theory. More precisely, we call, in a relativistic context, we talk about quantum field theories. Those are theories that are invariant under translations, but also under the connected component of the Lorentz group. That's what we mean by a quantum field theory. The theory may or may not be invariant under the disconnected components of the Lorentz group. But all of them are considered relativistic quantum field theories, as quantum field theories. So conformal field theory will be a theory that is Poincaré invariant, but endowed with extra symmetries. And so let me make a small parenthesis here, a philosophical parenthesis, that in physics, we are accustomed that we love symmetries in physics because they give huge constraints on the dynamics. This is true even in classical physics. So for example, if you study the motion of a particle in a potential, so this is a small parenthesis, literally. So if you study the motion of a particle in a potential like this, in this example, for example, the fact that energy is conserved allows you to reduce the second order differential equation that governs the motion of the particle to a first order differential equation, because you know that there is a conserved quantity, which is called the energy. That you can use to essentially reduce the order of your differential equation. Yeah. So symmetries are very important in organizing what can happen to your physical system. Okay. And so this was a very trivial example of how you can use symmetries to constrain and simplify the dynamics. Conformal field theories will be theories that will have the extra symmetries, and those extra symmetries will give us lots of constraints on the physics. So we'll be able to say a lot about conformal field theories just based on symmetries. So in the first part of the course, we will essentially exploit the consequences that space-time symmetries have on the dynamics of your system. By the way, as a little exercise, you could try to come up with an example of a potential, or a very specific potential, that gives rise to an extra symmetry conservation law other than the conservation of energy that has to do with time translational invariance, such that everything, even x, is determined, so that the dynamics of the system is fully determined by the conserved quantities. Let's call it E and Q. So you're familiar with this one, you're probably not familiar with the other one, but hopefully by the third lecture, you would be able to guess what is the form of the potential such that the dynamics is algebraically solved for once I give you the conserved quantum numbers E and Q. Okay. So I don't know if this will be an exercise, but if you want to challenge yourself, you can try to think about that. But it's just to emphasize how important symmetries are in solving for the dynamics of a system, both classically and quantum mechanically. Okay, end of parenthesis. Okay, but so in this course, we will mainly discuss relativistic space-time symmetries, but there is also a lot of interest in other physical systems that do not have relativistic invariants, that they're very important in condensed matter physics, for example. So you can also look for quantum field theories that are invariant under the Galilean algebra, which are relevant for non-relativistic quantum field theories. And then you can ask a similar question. Can you enlarge the symmetries of a Galilean invariant quantum field theory to extra symmetries that act on spacetime? And the answer to that will be yes also. Okay. So essentially what we want to do is enhance this to a conformal symmetry, which by definition will contain as part of it the Poincaré symmetry or the Galilean symmetry, depending on what you're studying. Okay. I should make also a comment that while the notion of conformal symmetry for Poincaré invariant field theories is unique, the notion of conformal symmetry is not unique for non-relativistic quantum field theories, and you can have several types of conformal invariant non-relativistic field theories. Okay. Good. Now, something I can say now that also gives you a sense of what's that this conformal symmetry is very special is that there is a theorem that one can prove that essentially says that you could ask the following question: what is the most general space-time symmetry that a non-trivial quantum field theory could have? By non-trivial means that the correlation functions and the S-matrix are not those of a trivial field theory. Trivial, I mean, a free field theory. And the answer to this question is quite subtle, but it turns out that it's precisely this. So conformal field theory, a conformal symmetry is the largest symmetry that a quantum field, that an untrivial quantum field theory can have. Let me write this. So, conformal symmetry. So we already see a certain uniqueness about conformal symmetry. It's the largest space-time symmetry. Again, it's important I'm talking about space-time symmetries. Of interacting quantum field theory. I lost my colors. So the key word here is interacting. By the way, there is a little caveat here. This is true in dimensions, space-time dimensions bigger than two. In two dimensions, there are special things that can happen. You can have extra space-time symmetry. So this is kind of the most symmetric theory that you can have, and therefore we're going to study it. But we are going to study it not because it's the most symmetric and the most constrained theory that we can study, but also because you will see that it plays a central role in our understanding of quantum field theory broadly, even the non-conformal ones. I should also say that if you allow, just to say some things that you may have heard of, that if you allow your theory to have not only bosonic generators, but fermionic generators of space-time symmetries, the theory, the largest symmetry you can have is what's called supersymmetric conformal field theory, or superconformal field theory. But in this course, we're going to talk about theories that do not have supersymmetry. But if you allow that, if you relax the condition that symmetries are implemented by bosonic operators and that satisfy Lie algebra, and you allow fermionic generators that generate a super Lie algebra, then you could, the most general symmetry would be a supersymmetric conformal field theory. Okay. So now I have to tell you, I'll give you some intuition of what is conformal symmetry is. So there is one particular element, one particular transformation that you're very familiar with. So let's try to discuss it a little bit. And then this will help us organize how this subject fits with all the subjects that you've been studying. So let's study, as an example of a conformal transformation, a scale transformation. So this is something you're familiar with. So this is essentially looking at the physical system at different length scales. Okay? So that's something that either implicitly or explicitly you've always done. Okay? Because whenever you study a physical system, you're usually asking the physics of the system at a particular length scale. If you change your length scale, the way you even describe the physical system will change. So for example, if you're studying what's inside your coffee mug, at some length scale, you can describe it just essentially classical physics with hydrodynamics. There is some fluid that moves in your liquid. Now, if you zoom to small distances, you'll start seeing the fact that the water is made out of atoms. So you will need to use, quantum mechanics. Quantum effects will start becoming important. And if you go to even much shorter distance, you have to understand the structure of the proton, and then you would need to worry about QCD and so on and so forth. And if you go deeper, you may have to understand quantum gravity. Okay? Now, of course, one thing that's important is that in order to understand water or QCD, we don't need to know about quantum gravity. If that was not the case, we would not have made any progress. Unlikely this is the case. And you'll get an intuition. I think you probably already have it from your field theory courses of what's the case, why we can understand physics at low energies without knowing all the details of what may be happening at very short distances, which we don't really know. Even though there are ambitious theories that try to ask that question of what is the ultimate theory at short distances. But we don't need that to study low energy physics. Low energy means like we are a low energy person. I mean, we're low energy. We're like, we feel they're big, but we're very low energy. So scale transformations are very important in the way we even think about physics. But now let's be a bit more concrete. So what does that mean in practice? So what it means is that it's a transformation that scales your space-like coordinates in this way, so lambda. So lambda is a real parameter. And in general, it rescales time in this way. So in general, if we allow the most general setting here, we allow to rescale space and time in different ways. And Z is called dynamical critical exponent. Now, of course, in a relativistic quantum field theory, since space and time are unified, Z has to equals one. I think that's clear. So in the relativistic context, we will organize the space and time into a d-dimensional space-time vector. So dilatations. So this time is called also dilatations, for obvious reasons. Just rescales homogeneously all the space-time coordinates. But in a non-relativistic setting, you can construct theories that have different dynamical critical exponents. So for example, a very simple example would be that you're familiar with is the Schrodinger equation. So if you write the Schrodinger equation, hope I'm not screwing it up. Now, this theory has a scale symmetry. You may not have been aware of this, but the Schrodinger equation has a scale symmetry. So given the definitions I have told you, can someone tell me what is the Z associated to the Schrodinger equation?
Two.
Z is two, yeah. But you can have other things. You could have, for example, a field theory that's not relativistic of this type. So for this theory, obviously, Z would be 3, because I have to rescale time and space in different ways. Okay. And this is something that I think you have a fairly intuition with. I mean, your computer, you can zoom in and zoom out of stuff, and you know what it means. Any questions about this? But this is not the entire story with conformal transformations. Now I'm going to give you like the more formal definition of what a conformal transformation is. That will include, obviously, this. So a conformal transformation is a space-time transformation that sends x mu to x mu tilde that preserves angles. So it preserves angles, but obviously it does not necessarily preserve distances. So more formally, what this means is that these are transformations of this type where your metric, ds squared, under this transformation has this property. You know, if this condition essentially tells you that the transformation has to be isotropic, so it cannot change the length element inhomogeneously, so that's why you have this overall scale factor. And you know, if you rescale the metric by an overall scale factor, the angles do not change, because when you look at the inner products to compute the angles, this factor drops out. But in general, this can be a function of x, which is not arbitrary, and that's something that we will solve for more detail tomorrow. We will find what is the most general transformation of this type that has this property of preserving angles, but not necessarily preserving length. So some of the transformations you're already familiar with. So obviously, Poincaré symmetry, by definition, is a space-time symmetry that preserves the metric, right? So Poincaré transformations. So Poincaré is included in here with sigma being zero. Obviously, from this transformation here, dilatations are included where, e to the 2 sigma x is just a constant, lambda, I guess lambda square. And then will be other ones that we will solve for what is called a special conformal transformation, which is a bit harder to have an intuition for, but we will get one by tomorrow, special conformal transformation. And the thing that's interesting is that if you ask this geometrical question, what is the most general transformation that preserves angles, the space of solutions is finite dimensional. So it's a finite dimensional set of transformations. And these transformations will generalize the Poincaré group to conformal. And we will study the details of that tomorrow. But for the purposes of just motivating this lecture today to tell you the broad picture of how conformal field theories fit in the landscape, this is sufficient. OK. So now, what I want to discuss a little bit next is why. So obviously, it may seem to you rather special that quantum field theory will have this symmetry. I mean, this essentially says that the theory looks the same at all length scales. That's not typically what happens when you study a theory. Whenever you have an intrinsic length scale in the theory, like a mass scale or an intrinsic length scale, like lambda QCD, the theory is obviously not, it's not going to be invariant under scale transformations because there is a length scale into the problem. But nevertheless, I will explain now in what sense conformal field theories play a central role in our understanding of the space of all quantum field theories, even the massive ones. So let me start somewhere. So what we want to ask now is why CFTs? So one place in which CFTs canonically appear is when you study. So the asymptotic large distance behavior of a quantum field theory. So now you can ask the following question. Take any quantum field that you like and ask, what are the possible behaviors that this quantum field theory can have at asymptotically large distances? At distances much larger than any length scale that your physical system has, okay? Now, there are essentially two things that can happen. So there is one situation which in particle physics is usually considered to be trivial or gapped, okay, or massive. Gapping is also massive. So these are essentially systems in which things are massive. And if things are massive, it means that the correlation functions of local operators in your theory, so like OX or Y, will have some exponential decay, okay? That's what it means that things are gapped. You know from just the propagator of the Yukawa theory that if you have massive particles, the correlation functions between operators decay exponentially, okay? Now, if you go to the extreme infrared limit, essentially what this means is that all the correlation functions of local operators vanish. So that means that in such a situation, in the extreme infrared, there are no local operators. So this is in the sense in which we call these theories trivial. There are no local operators, which are the ones that you mostly have been studying in your field theory. But, and that will be a subject of some other course, but there is a refinement to this story, which is interesting, which is that even though you can end up with a, in the extreme infrared, with a theory that has no local operators, there can be situations in which in the infrared, you get a non-trivial, what's called topological quantum field theory. So, or TQFT, which is, this is a theory that does not depend on the local dynamic, on the local properties of your system. This is compatible with the fact that it has no local operators. If it had local operators, the theory would know about points, and a topological field theory only knows about the global topology of the space-time. And these topological quantum field theories have the property that they have no local operators, but they can have, so they have no local operators, but can have non-local operators. They can have the existence of non-local operators. So things like, if you've seen that in gauge theory, Wilson loops, things like that. Okay? And such topological quantum field theories play a central role, actually also in particle physics as of recently. So they play a role in describing, they describe the infrared dynamics. And these are pretty recent developments of QCD theories in 2+1 dimensions, but also describe the dynamics of many condensed matter systems. And for example, these non-local operators encode the properties of your excitations in the infrared. So for example, they would tell you about the braiding properties as you move particles, heavy particles around in your system, like it will tell you, the braiding properties. Essentially tells you what are the phases that particles acquire when you move them around each other. This is especially true in 2+1 dimensions. But of course, there are topological field theories in other dimensions. But this is one, yes?
Good question. This extreme IR limit you're taking, does it mean that X is really large?
Yes.
So I don't quite understand this, no local operators then.
So
if they're really far away, then there's no correlation, so.
No, you could have operators that, so if the correlation functions of all local operators vanish, it means that the local operator vanishes, mm-hmm. Okay? But the non-local operators could have correlation functions that do not decay at large distances, so they survive in the infrared limit.
But here in this limit, if X is really large.
But this is the correlation function of a local operator. You have to think how the correlation functions of a non-local operator.
Oh, it's completely different.
Yes, they're different. Yes.
I think she wants her to give an example. What is a Wilson loop?
What is a Wilson loop?
They don't know that.
Could you explain the arrow, please?
Yeah, so. Okay, so this first part is more or less clear. That so now take X very large. It means that the correlation function, so the two-point function of any local operator vanishes. Now there is a theorem in relativistic quantum field theory that tells you that if the two-point function of an operator with its conjugate vanishes, the operator vanishes. So that means that there is no local operator in the infrared. It has decoupled in the extreme infrared limit. Now this does not happen for non-local operators.
So O doesn't exist, that's what you mean?
O does not, L0, it decouples. Another physical way of saying it decouples. It has no image in the extreme infrared limit.
What do you mean by no image?
So it doesn't exist, it's zero. So you're familiar when you go from large, short distance to large distances, that as you do that, you integrate out the heavy particles, right? So imagine now that you integrate you got energy is very, very small, and what you had was all massive fields. After you're done integrating all of them out, there is nothing left, right? But there is a subtle refinement, is that you could be left with no local operators, but you could still have something non-trivial. Just think of a collection of very massive particles, and go to energy is much smaller than all the massive particles. You integrate everything out, there is nothing left. I mean, are you familiar with the concept that if you have a massive field, and you got that energy is much lower than the mass, that you can integrate out the massive field?
Effective field theory isn't emphasize the point in their background.
Okay, so maybe it's something we can reinforce later on. But the basic intuition is simple: is that if you imagine you're doing physics at some energy scale, and you start with a theory that has a particle which is much heavier than the energy scale that you're studying, you essentially cannot produce that particle, right? So that means that in your path integral, you can systematically take into account the effect of a very massive particle by integrating it out. That means that to leading order, it has very little effect on the low energy physics, and the effect of the massive particle is measured in the coefficients of what are called irrelevant operators, so operators of higher dimension. So what can happen is that if everything is massive, and you go to length scales where everyone is gone, you're left with no fields from which you can write operators. You have no fields in the infrared, you're going to write any local operator. There can be global modes, but discussing this, I think, would be a huge detour. I just wanted to mention is that this is quite an active area in condensed matter and also high energy now. And I'll just write so someone asked what a Wilson loop is. This is an operator that's supported on a curve in space-time. And essentially is the world line of an electrically charged particle. So for a U1 gauge theory, would be the integral over the curve C of the gauge field. This essentially tells you this is the way an electrically charged particle that moves on this curve couples to electromagnetism. This is the standard electromagnetic coupling, A mu, J mu. Okay, so this is what can happen. The other thing that can happen is that almost by definition, once you have gone to distances much larger than any other scale in the problem, you'll be left by definition with a scale invariant theory. Which means that the theory will acquire an extra symmetry. So again, we will enhance from Poincaré to Poincaré, okay, semi-direct with R. This is the dilatation that we discussed there. Now, this happens almost by definition because you removed all the scales, so there is no scale in the problem, so it has to be scale invariant. Now, it could happen that the scale invariant theory is empty. And that can happen, but there are many examples in which the scale invariant theory that you get is interesting. And that's the one we will focus on. Now, the fact that, as I said, the fact that the symmetry enhances in the infrared, so there's a symmetry enhancement here. So we went from a Poincaré to Poincaré times something. This will provide lots of constraints on your theory. In particular, it will constrain dramatically the form of the correlation functions on the theory. Okay. So you already have an intuition about how the correlation function of massive theory behaves. It has an exponential decay. Now, if the theory is a scale invariant, there is no mass scale in the problem. And this essentially dramatically constrains the form that the correlation function can have, because there is now no mass scale in the problem. And this essentially will tell us that the correlation functions in a conformal field theory have power law behavior, so that they have power law in this. So this will imply that if you look at the correlation function of two operators in a conformal field theory, they will have to decay with 1 over the distance to some power. So the correlation function will have homogeneous properties under scale transformations. Because now there is no length scale that you could put to create some scale invariant quantity. So it's essentially uniquely fixed. Okay. And a lot of the interest will be in understanding what these numbers are. These are the scaling dimensions. Of operators. On this case of the operator O. Now, something I should say that I will not spend too much time is that this enhancement is manifest from the physics of it, that we're going to any where there is no longer a length scale. And this is an arrow that is partially proved, partially not. It happens that the symmetry of the infrared theory further enhances from Poincaré times dilatations to the full conformal symmetry. Okay. And this is very good because conformal transformations are larger than scale transformations on Poincaré. So the constraints that the conformal field theory has are larger than the constraints that the Poincaré times dilatational theory has. So the fact that nature chooses this, like for example in the 3D Ising model, there are strong arguments that the theory is not only scale invariant but conformal invariant. So the fact that the nature chooses to be not scale invariant but actually conformal invariant is very good because that constrains the correlation functions of the Ising model a lot. Because it gives us further constraints. Okay, so one point, so one kind of meta point where CFTs canonically appear is when you study the asymptotic low energy limit of any quantum field theory. These are the things that, you know, live at the end of a long RG flow from short distances to extreme large distances. Okay. One thing that we will discuss a little bit later in the course is that, and that plays an important role in understanding why conformal field theories are important, is that conformal field theories provide an ordering in the space of quantum field theories. Okay, we will discuss this more later. An ordering means that this will tell us, essentially it's like a mountain. It tells you which theory, which conformal field theory can be obtained from which other one by going down the mountain. So renormalization group flow, which is the statement that going from short distances to large distances is irreversible. That means that you can only flow okay, we'll come back to that. And these CFTs will provide us a way of thinking about the very complicated and abstract space of all quantum field theories. It will give us kind of level sets, it will give a height function or energy function in the space of quantum field theories that tell us the logical relation between different quantum field theories. Quantum field theories can only go from one height to a smaller height, not the other way around. And we will define what this height function is, at least in some examples. Okay, so it doesn't sound so abstract. Now let's discuss examples. And you're going to tell me some examples of conformal invariant of a scale invariant theory. So remember, these are theories that do not have an intrinsic length scale. So can you give me some examples of theories that you know that have this property? Or equations of motion or something?
Massless Klein-Gordon.
Massless Klein-Gordon. Can you make it a bit more interesting and still be scale invariant?
Lambda pi 4, I think.
In 4 dimensions, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Something else?
Maxwell.
Sorry?
Maxwell equations.
Maxwell, yeah. also relatedly Young-Mills equation. Even though, I mean, this one is a quadratic theory, linear theory. This one is not, but at least classically, it has no scale. The Gates coupling constant, so G, is dimensionless. Any other one? So we have here a spin 0. Here we have a spin 1. Is there some theory with spin 1/2 that's scale invariant? Sorry? Why two dimensions? Actually, free fermion is a scale invariant in any dimension. Right? There is no scale here. The free Dirac equation is a scale invariant. And then you can other things. Is there some other interaction? So now we had kind of self interactions of a spin 0, self interactions of spin 1. This is not interacting, but actually, what you could do in two dimensions is write this term. And that term, this would be scale invariant if you play around with the dimensional analysis in D equals 2. So we have self-interacting theories of spin 0, 1, and 1/2. Is there some other interaction between, say, a spin 1/2 and a spin 1, and a spin 0 that you can write down that's scale invariant? Can you think of a coupling that you can write down between, so write a coupling that involves phi, which is spin 0, and psi, which is spin 1/2?
Yukawa,
yeah. So G, whatever, phi, sorry, by psi. So if you put the coupling constant here, this guy is dimensionless, and this is classically a scale invariant. So the Lagrangian of Yukawa theory is a scale invariant if the masses are 0. OK, so you see that essentially all the equations that you know from your field theories, if you turn off the masses, like if you turn off the mass of the scalar field or you turn off the mass of the fermion, you cannot really give a mass to a Gates field. That is not compatible with Gates invariance. You see that the theory that you get is a scale invariant. So actually, you would say that the scale invariant is ubiquitous. I mean, essentially, all the theories that you've studied are scale invariant. But there is an issue here. The point is that this is a classical statement. And as you know, in quantum field theory, or more generally in quantum mechanics, quantum effects change this. Quantum corrections change this. Essentially, you know, the coupling constants of your theory due to the virtual particles. So essentially give your coupling constants a dependence on the energy scale. So this implies that couplings depend on energy scale. So for example, you're familiar with this in QCD, famously, that, let's see, so this is the energy scale. So the coupling constant of QCD is small at very short distances or very large energies, right? That's where perturbation theory is valid. But the coupling constant grows at large distances or at low energies. And this is due to the fact that even though classically the coupling constant didn't depend on the energy scale, due to the fact that there are essentially screening effects due to virtual particles in your system, the coupling constant acquires a energy scale dependence. So the theory is no longer scale invariant quantum mechanically. So it's classically scale invariant, but not quantum mechanically scale invariant. And the fact that this is happening is measured in what's called the beta function of the coupling. You can define a beta function of this type for any coupling constant that you have. It could be one for Yukawa, one for Yang-Mills, one for this guy. It essentially measures the dependence of the coupling with respect to the energy scale. Okay? And now the point is that quantum mechanically, this can be non-zero. Okay? So now we have to see that even though classically they were ubiquitous, quantum mechanically, unless there is some small miracle, the coupling constant will tend to change with the scale and the theory will cease to be scale invariant or unconformal invariant. So now let's try to understand a little bit better this picture we were having about what happens to a theory. So now we want to understand a little bit better the following thing. So let's start with a field theory. And now let's deform this theory by a certain operator. The example you could have in mind is just free field theory. Just start with free field theory. And now imagine deforming the theory by some quartic coupling. And you want to ask what kind of effect does turning on the coupling has in the extreme infrared. Okay? And that's essentially some just dimensional analysis, at least to start with. Is there a clock? Oh, yeah. I'm going super slow, but that's okay. So now what we want to study is the following. So we want to study some theory. So let's start with some theory here. This could be, just for concrete, imagine you start with a conformal field theory. Imagine you start with one of those classically conformal invariant theories, okay? And now you want to deform the theory by some operator. And I'm going to use this notation, lambda O. So this is some operator in your theory. This theory has a list of operators. You can make a list. And now you deform the theory by, you could imagine, in general, the following question, which is a hard question, is to list all the local operators and ask what happens to your theory when I deform this theory by an arbitrary deformation that I can write down. Now, and we want to ask what happens, and I think you know a little bit about this already, but so maybe I can go a bit faster. I want to know what happens in the infrared. And now, one important quantity that characterizes the physics that can happen in the infrared is the following. So the physics will depend, IR physics. On the dimension of the operator O. And we usually call this dimension delta. This is the same delta, by the way, that appeared somewhere here. Yeah. Actually, to be precise, that's the right definition. Okay? And essentially from dimensional analysis, what you find is that the behavior of the perturbation produced by the operator O depends on whether the dimension delta of the operator is bigger, smaller, or equal to the space-time dimension. So if delta of the operator is bigger than the space-time dimension, so D is the space-time dimension, then we call these operators irrelevant because they are, and the reason we call them irrelevant is that they are unimportant in the infrared. So the effects, so if you deform your theory by an irrelevant operator, the effect of that interaction at low energies is very, very small. Okay? this is very good and for the progress of humanity, and as you will see in a moment. Now, you could have the delta smaller than d, and then this is relevant. It's the opposite. So an example of this, so it doesn't sound like crazy nonsense, is, for example, if I add the operator box phi cubed to your scalar field theory, the effect of this interaction to your scattering of phi particles is very, very small at low energies. Essentially because the coupling constant that multiplies this here now has a mass dimension which is negative, so that essentially the effect of this amplitude of this interaction will be of the order of the energy of the process divided by lambda, times lambda, which will be very small at low energies. Now this is relevant, is the opposite, is that important in infrared. And a canonical example of that is actually the Young-Mills is like that, right? I mean, this picture is exactly like that. The Young-Mills coupling constant becomes important in the infrared Young-Mills coupling. And then you can have a miracle, which is an exception, where delta equals d, and then we call this guy marginal. Is neither relevant nor irrelevant. And now this guy is has a very special property in relation to the discussion we've been having of conformal field theory. Because while deforming the theory by this operator or this operator infinitesimally breaks scale invariance, because the coupling constant conjugate to O, both for this case and this case, will have a non-trivial mass dimension. And we said that if you have a non-trivial mass dimension, the theory cannot be scale invariant. While if the operator that you deform by has dimension d, then lambda is dimensionless, and this deformation preserves the scale invariance. Okay? So you have a one-parameter family. If there is such an operator, you have a one-parameter family of scale invariant theories. Now, typically what happens is that, and this is the examples here, is that you can have an operator that's classically marginal, but not quantum mechanically. So typically what happens is that quantum effects make this operator what's called marginally irrelevant. For example, that's the phi to the fourth interaction. The beta function of lambda phi to the four at one loop is positive. Like, for example, lambda phi to the four. Or marginally relevant. So here, actually, I should have. It's better here if I write something different. I write like psi bar psi. A marginally relevant would do. The example would be Young-Mills, which was classically marginal, but quantum mechanically. So this has a positive beta function, this has a negative beta function, which means that the coupling, by integrating this equation, you see that if the beta function is positive, the coupling constant decreases towards the infrared, while if it's negative, it increases towards infrared. Okay. So what does this mean, essentially? So it means that, again, in the philosophy of trying to make progress without knowing everything at arbitrary short distances is the following, is that the fact that the low energy physics, and again, we are low energy by any measure, the fact that the low energy physics is essentially controlled by these operators, is crucial for us to make any progress. Because, first of all, so if you take any of your theories and you try to write down all operators, can someone tell me where would most of the operators lie? In this set, or in this set? So take your favorite theory. You have a favorite theory? Yeah. And then write all the operators, all the local operators you can write down. And now you they will fit in one of, there are no more options, right? These are the three options. Where will the operator, most of the operators fit? In this set, or this set?
I have a question.
The fact that an operator is marginally irrelevant or marginally relevant depends not on an operator, but also on the other operators in the theory, right?
Yes, yes. There can be operator mixing. You may have to re-diagonalize. Yeah. But you can always diagonalize operators and then, yeah. So let's take, free scalar field. So give me examples of operators you can write down. So any polynomial of phi is a good operator, right? Now, if you write a generic polynomial of phi, where is it? Is it here, here, or here? It's irrelevant. Especially because you know phi has a has a certain dimension, right? Has dimension in four dimensions would be one. So if you go beyond phi to the fourth in four dimensions, the phi to the fifth has dimension five, phi to the sixth has dimension six, blah blah blah. So by and large, the immense majority of operators you write down are irrelevant. Actually, and the number of operators that are relevant or irrelevant is very small. Essentially, like in phi to the fourth. Well, and if you impose a Z2 symmetry, there are actually only two operators, the mass operator and lambda phi, and lambda. Lambda phi to the fourth is not, you know, quantum mechanically becomes marginally irrelevant, right? So essentially, you only have the mass operator that's a relevant operator. And this is good. Why? Because it means that, you know, if you have some knowledge of your low energy physics, you know, by experiment or whatever, that your system has a spin zero or spin one particles, but you don't really know what is the ultimate short distance physics, right? So you don't know what's going on. But then you can just take a humble point of view and just say, what is the most general thing that I can write down giving the knowledge of the content of particles and the symmetry of the problem that could describe that physics, okay? Now, if this were not true, that irrelevant operators are unimportant in the infrared, you would be stuck with having to study lambda phi to the trillion theory. While now, because of this decoupling idea that most operators are not important in the infrared, you are left with study with a small set of interactions that are important in the infrared. And then you can essentially parameterize your ignorance of the short distance physics that we have. We don't know what's happening at the Planck scale. And the way we parameterize that ignorance essentially is by the parameters of this operator. So these are some coupling constants that we cannot measure from first principles, right? We don't know how to compute. Okay, so there are theories like string theory that in principle compute for you the coupling constants. But in this approach of field theory, of effective field theory, the coupling constant is something that's given to you. It's not something that you compute. It's a parameter, and you fit that parameter to experiment, to fit low energy experiment. And then once you fitted enough experiments so that all your parameters are fixed, then you can start making predictions for other processes. So essentially, the fact that irrelevant operators are not important, and that the set of relevant or marginal operators is small, this is why we can make progress in the absence of knowledge of the short distance theory. Yeah.
So you gave the example of a free scalar, a scalar theory, but is it always true that the majority of operators
yes.
are irrelevant? Like for whatever theory you give me?
Find me a theory where the dimension of an operator is negative. That's essentially inconsistent with unitarity.
Okay.
You can do this exercise, take write down all interactions you can write down out of a spin a half and spin one particle, and you will see that they have this property. But actually,
sorry, so can I just call like O prime lambda times O, and then suddenly O prime becomes marginal?
Can you repeat that?
Like, let's say I call lambda O prime.
Lambda O prime? Can you write it down?
I just define like another operator, it equals lambda times O prime, times O.
Operate? I'm not following. You mean this?
I'm defining a new operator. It's just, now that new operator has the dimension of space, not
there. Okay, no, but here one has to be a bit careful. Okay, so this is a standard problem. There are two different notions of dimensions in the world. There is the notion of mass dimension, which is the dimension under dimensional analysis, that, you know, the Lagrangian has to be dimensionless, right? And then there is a more subtle notion of dimension, which is what's relevant here, that we have not yet really spelled out clearly, but we will, which is the way an operator transforms under a dilatation. Okay. So I'll say something now. This will be explained very carefully later on. But this is a good question, because you're saying that I have changed the dimension by putting a lambda here. You're essentially saying that I should count the dimensions. Let me say the following point. There is mass dimension and there is scale dimension. And the scale dimension is different in the following sense, that if you take x mu, let me define what the scale dimension is, and we will, of course, deduce much more later, because this is one of the crucial pieces of data that we need to solve for in a conformal field theory. So we make this transformation, right? This dilatation transformation. Delta, by definition, is if you take phi of x, okay, let me say O of x, some operator O of x. This defines what delta is. Lambda inverse x. Okay. So delta essentially is the charge of the operator O under dilatations. Okay. And what matters for this business is the charge under dilatations. Now, the thing that's confusing is that in free field theory, this notion of delta and the notion of engineering mass dimension coincides. But that's no longer true in general. Okay. For example, under a scale transformation like this, you transform the fields, right? You don't transform the parameters in your Lagrangian. So that's a good question.